From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Since September 11th, the government has conducted over 600 secret deportation hearings, refused to release the names and locations of most of those detained, and held people for months after their cases were completed, all against Muslim immigrants from South Asia, the Middle East, and North Africa.
Last month, the Justice Department secretly airlifted 100, or I should say deported 131 Pakistani detainees held in an INS detention center for months. No one's been charged with terrorism. We'll look at new documents that reveal shocking plans to promote using psychopharmacological weapons and mind-altering drugs here in the United States. Valium sprays, chemical cocktails, hallucinogens, fast-acting antidepressants, and animal tranquilizers. We'll speak to a bioweapons expert about the documents he obtained under the Freedom of Information Act. Then look at the Pakistani intelligence services links to Ahmad Omar Saeed Sheikh, a leading Islamic fundamentalist with reported ties to the alleged chief suspect in the murder of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Zacharias Moussaoui stunned a packed courtroom Thursday by twice trying to enter a guilty plea. Moussaoui is accused of conspiring the September 11th attacks. He so far denied the charge. On Thursday, he said, quote, "I want to enter a plea of guilty because this will ensure to save my life because this is conspiracy law." But a guilty plea would not necessarily save his life. Moussaoui also said he participated in al-Qaeda and is loyal to Osama bin Laden. Under the federal death penalty, if the judge allowed Moussaoui to plead guilty, a jury would then have to be impaneled to consider whether he could be put to death, even though there was no jury for the trial itself. The penalty phase before the jury would be, in effect, a full trial because it would have to cover the same ground as a trial. Under a Supreme Court opinion rendered last month, the judge could impose the death penalty only after the recommendation of a jury. The judge warned Moussaoui about the consequences of such a plea and took the virtually unprecedented step of refusing to enter his plea. Moussaoui wouldn't stop talking until she threatened to call in federal marshals. The judge gave Moussaoui a week to reconsider his decision and scheduled a hearing for next Thursday. A dispute has erupted between Peru and Latin America's human rights watchdog over whether the trial of Lori Berenson, an American serving a 20-year prison term, was fair. Peru said Tuesday it will challenge the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights after the group found fault with the trial of Lori Berenson. Peru says it will take the case to the Costa Rica-based Inter-American Court of Human Rights, which is part of the Organization of American States. We'll have more on that story on Monday. Here at home, a federal appeals court Tuesday overturned the attempted extortion conviction of an African-American abortion doctor. Dr. James Pendergraft had filed a federal lawsuit against Marion County, Florida, charging the clinic was not given adequate protection against anti-abortion protesters. County officials in turn slapped Pendergraft with a lawsuit alleging he was involved in an extortion scheme to profit from the closure of the clinic. He was convicted and has already served 7 months in prison. A new report shows Latino and Latina youth are incarcerated for drug offenses at 13 times the rate of white youth. The study is the first ever national analysis of Latino and Latina youth in the juvenile justice system. Marissa DeMeo is regional counsel for the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
The significance of your report.
Well, this report put out by Building Blocks for Youth is really the first study to document on a national level the pervasive practices of both police departments and our judicial system to over-incarcerate and over-detain Latino youth. The significance for us is that this part of the population is a growing and a very important part of the nation's population. The largest minority community, 18 and under, is now Latinos. And if we're putting these children in higher rates than their representation in the population in the juvenile justice system, we're really sending these children down the wrong path and setting a line of future for our community that is very problematic and will lead to crisis results.
Marissa DeMeo of the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund. And finally, over 150 Nigerian women have ended their peaceful protest against Chevron in the Niger Delta today. The women had occupied Chevron's main oil export facility for 10 days, halting the movement of oil and trapping hundreds of U.S., British, Canadian, and Nigerian workers inside. The Niger Delta is one of the poorest places in Nigeria. Despite its oil wealth, Nigeria is the fifth largest supplier of oil to the United States. After days of negotiations, Chevron company executives agreed to build schools, clinics, town halls, and provide electricity and water systems in villages of rusty tin shacks. The protest inspired other women to seize four other oil facilities in the region. Yesterday, I spoke with Anyakwe Nisirimovu, executive director of the Institute of Human Rights and Humanitarian Law in Port Harcourt in the Niger Delta. Yesterday, he talked about why the women were protesting.
Most of the people in this part of the Niger Delta depend on land and water for their daily life. And as a result of oil extraction, productivity is very, very low. And the people expect the oil company, Chevron, in this particular instance, to be able to put back in the communities infrastructures, give jobs to local people, build health centers, especially in a situation where you have oil spills that pollute the environment and the waters very frequently. And now we have the women who are fed up with what has been happening and have decided to abandon their culture to come out and protest. I think it's an extreme measure because in this part, you hardly find women coming out, you know, to do this kind of protest. And for the past 10 days, the women, over 150 women, went out there and blockaded the oil fields. And over 800 workers in that area were not allowed to come out.
And very briefly, again, their demands, the demands of the women are?
Jobs in the communities, infrastructures like schools, markets, health centers, because as a result of oil extraction, you have acid rain, you have pollution of all kinds, and people are dying. And most of these people live very far away from the city where you can get any meaningful hospital. Most of them live very far away from high schools where their children can go to school. And the least they expect is that the oil company should put in, it doesn't cost so much, to put in some of these facilities very close to them so that, for instance, the health requirement will reduce the amount of people that die of, you know, little things like people are in a maternity condition who want to have their baby before they can transport them from that local community to the town. People die on the way, you know, in the process. That is just all they are asking for from Chevron. And of course, the issue of employment, they have youths who are loitering about. Some of them are graduates who need jobs, but they are not being employed. Yet, day in, day out, they watch oil workers, very rich oil workers, parade their streets with, you know, expensive vehicles. And they have nothing. In the midst of plenty, they are terribly poor. They live in abject poverty. They want their livelihood to be improved. They want, while they are taken away from their community, for some kind of investment to be made in that community. That is all they are asking for. And they have done that peacefully.
Finally, we understand that the women threaten to disrobe and that would shame those who saw them. Is this the case? We read it in a Reuters piece, a Newswire piece.
Yeah, the women are willing to do that. I think it has happened before, that the women are willing to go to that extreme situation if nobody is listening to them. And, of course, what that means in our culture here in the Delta is that it's not something that is, you know, just done, and it's something that is done in an extreme situation. And it goes to show how deeply these women feel about this and how dangerous it could be. Because if they go to that extreme, what it means is that there's going to be a long-term animosity between the oil company and the communities, because even their men will not take that very, very lightly, to have their wives and daughters derobed.
Anyakwe Sirimovu, Executive Director of the Institute of Human Rights and Humanitarian Law in Port Harcourt, the Niger Delta. You are listening to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
And welcome to our listeners.
Well, we're going to move right into our first story today. In a 1971 book called The Futurological Congress, Polish writer Stanisław Lem portrayed a future in which disobedience is controlled with hypothetic mind-altering chemicals he dubbed benignomizers. In the opening scene of the book, police attack protesters outside an international scientific convention with hallucinogenic agents. As the protesters and bystanders are saturated with the agents, they're overcome by delusions and feelings of complacency and love. Well, now, new revelations suggest Stanisław Lem may have been more a prophet than a fiction writer. A small Texas-based nonprofit has obtained Pentagon reports revealing shocking plans to promote psychopharmacological weapons and mind-altering drugs.
According to a report the Sunshine Project obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, the Pentagon's Joint Non-Lethal Weapons Program conducted an extensive review of medical literature and new developments in the pharmaceutical industry. The report concludes, quote, the development and use of psychopharmacological weapons is achievable and desirable. The drugs that Lem called benignomizers are called calmatives by the military. The military was supposed to remove such drugs from its stockpiles following the adoption of the Chemical Weapons Convention in 1993. But the Pentagon has other plans. They include using everything from Valium sprays, hallucinogenics, chemical cocktails, fast-acting antidepressants, to animal tranquilizers, and a host of drugs that didn't make it past the FDA because of excessive side effects. According to the Sunshine Project, some of the techniques discussed in the report have already been used by the U.S. in the so-called War on Terrorism.
This as Washington beats the drums of war and marches towards an invasion of Iraq because Iraq allegedly possesses biological weapons. Well, Democracy Now! Called the Joint Non-Lethal Weapons Project to ask them to join us today, but our calls weren't returned. We are joined, however, by Edward Hammond, who is a bioweapons expert at the Sunshine Project, which is a small international non-governmental organization that works to avert the dangers of biological weapons. The project's name refers to how biological weapons break down and are rendered harmless by exposure to bright sunlight. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Edward Hammond.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you with us. Can you talk about what it is that you found, what the documents say that you got under the Freedom of Information Act?
Well, basically, starting over a year ago, we noticed that the Joint Non-Lethal Weapons Program was looking into these so-called calmative agents, which are really central nervous system depressants. And we started a long FOIA process. What we got back eventually, and it was a pretty torturous process, were a series of documents, a report that was almost 50 pages long that assessed a whole variety of drugs, both legal drugs and illegal drugs, to use to control crowds, mainly by the Marine Corps, by other military agencies in quote-unquote peacekeeping missions or in missions abroad. And we also got back some interesting documents from war games that were conducted exploring the uses of these agents with the United Kingdom, where there was a sharp divide over what was legal and what was not. And a series of other research and weapons proposals from companies, also from mainly other government labs.
Well, at Hammond, I mean, for somebody who's accustomed to knowing the deep secrets that our government keeps, I have to admit I was astounded by some of the material that you found in this information. Could you talk a little bit about those agents that could be considered biological weapons and, in essence, really violating the existing international conventions?
Sure. Well, almost everything that's discussed in the report on calmatives is illegal, either under the Chemical Weapons Convention or under the Biological Weapons Convention. The ones that, or both, in fact, because there's a little bit of an overlap. The ones that are illegal under the Biological Weapons Convention are what are called neurotransmitters, and these are the chemicals which occur naturally in your body, which transmit signals within your nervous system. And any substance, and a lot of pharmaceuticals mimic the action of a neurotransmitter, or in fact, they're developing literally synthesized copies of neurotransmitters. And so the drugs that are identified in the report, or the drug development processes that are identified in the report that relate to these neurotransmitters, are in fact biological weapons, because they are either natural chemicals or natural biological chemicals, or they're synthesized copies of them, and they're prohibited under international law as well as federal law.
Can you talk about how Valium would be used?
The report, which was authored by the Applied Research Laboratory at Pennsylvania State University, a military contractor, specifically identifies a drug called Presidex and Valium, and prioritizes them for potential use as weapons. Valium belongs to a class of drugs called benzodiazepines, which are used as sedatives. We know that right now they are continuing research on mixing OC, which is pepper gas, with a calmative agent. And we suspect that there is a strong possibility that Valium may be the agent that they're trying to mix with pepper gas. And the idea is that it would make pepper gas, quote-unquote, more effective, by adding something which would essentially penetrate, not only repel the person that was sprayed, but would penetrate their cognition, would go into their mind and make them less likely to resist, less able to resist, and more passive in the face of a military or police attempt to control them.
You also mentioned a drug called fentanyls, which are about 100 times more potent than heroin. And you quote from the report saying that the drug's profound effects may make it necessary to, quote, check for the occasional person who may stop breathing, as well as victims who go to sleep. In other words, people who OD from this application. So there's actual consideration of using something even more powerful than heroin on people?
Oh, yeah. In fact, the cover of the report features a chemical diagram of fentanyl. And it and a number of the other drugs that are identified in the report can lead to death, coma, and obviously whenever you're talking about forcibly altering somebody's mind, permanent psychological damage. And so, in fact, the report acknowledges that there could very well be deaths or very, very serious injuries resulting from the use of these.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll continue with Ed Hammond. He's with the Sunshine Project and has just gotten these Freedom of Information Act documents on a Pentagon program that promotes psychopharmacological warfare. Stay with us.
No, sometimes think it's me, but but you know, I think that it's a dream. I think I know, I mean, oh yes, but it's all wrong. That is, I think I disagree. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. Strawberry Fields forever.
Strawberry Fields Forever, the Bobs. Here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we talk about Pentagon plans that have not gotten very much attention, but plans to promote using psychopharmacological weapons and mind-altering drugs here in the United States. We're talking about Valium sprays on crowds, hallucinogenics, fast-acting antidepressants, and animal tranquilizers. Our guest is Ed Hammond, and he's with a group called the Sunshine Project. When you allow sun to shine on some of these biological weapons, they actually break down. It also helps all information coming out, that good old sunshine, Juan.
Well, there's one other drug that you mentioned, Precedex, and can you tell about the what they found about Precedex and how they're considering using it in terms of electroshock treatments?
Well, yeah, Precedex is a relatively new drug, and it's only approved in the U.S. For use on really critically ill people who are on generally on an artificial respirator, so in an emergency room. And the report considers Precedex's use as a weapon, and I'm not going to really speculate on what the authors of the report were thinking, but I can tell you what the report says. And the report says that that Precedex increases its people who are exposed to its sensitivity to electrical shock. And one of the other areas of weapons that the Joint Non-Lethal Weapons Program is looking at are electromagnetic weapons. So the report says that it would be possible to expose a crowd of people to the pharmacological agent, Precedex, and then if afterwards an electromagnetic weapon was used, it would knock down and knock out all of the people who were not immediately overcome by the pharmacological agent. Now, obviously, if you're talking about use of a pharmaceutical, military use of a pharmaceutical, which increases sensitivity to electrical shock, I think it's pretty obvious that this technique, actually in and of itself, as proposed, could be considered torture. Certainly, the use of Precedex in that manner could definitely be used to torture people, and I find it to be an extremely disturbing and thing to include in a report like this.
Now, there are those who might say on the government side that, well, they've got to keep abreast of the potential dangerous effects of various chemicals and their use on human beings in order to be able to develop defenses about them. Was there any sense in your reading of these reports that was the real intention of this?
No, absolutely not. This report, and in fact the Joint Non-Lethal Weapons Program, is all about developing weapons. There is no defensive or analytical in that sense aspect to it. This is an effort which is 100% dedicated towards developing new weapons for our Army and Navy and other services to use in the field, as well as the National Institutes of Justice, which is part of the Department of Justice, is involved as well, and looking at the application of these same weapons potentially by police in the United States.
And what about club drugs?
Yeah, that was a very interesting part of the report. It specifies that club drugs should be subjected to more study and assessment for possible use as weapons. And the club drugs that are identified are ketamine, which is called Special K on the street, GHB, liquid ecstasy, and also Roypanol. The last two are also called date rape drugs. And yeah, the report says that that perhaps the military, well, not perhaps, it says the military should look into these three drugs and figure out if there are ways that they can be used on rioters, protesters, in various other manners where you might want to use a quote-unquote non-lethal weapon, which are actually defined in the government's own definition as not being not lethal. Rather, they just kill less often.
I don't know if people are aware of the history of the use of psychopharmacological drugs by the U.S. government, but the use of LSD, slipping unknowing American citizens or people in this country drugs to test their effects. Edward Hammond, can you comment on this? People might be shocked to even know that that's the case, that LSD was experimented on many Americans by the U.S. government.
Yeah, well, that's definitely true. In the 50s and 60s, there were covert programs that were operated to try to identify particularly hallucinogenics, and figure out ways that the military could use them. I think that with this particular case, the historical parallel that I like to draw is that of the use of chemical weapons in warfare in advance. You know, when a gas cloud is coming at you, you don't know what it is. And historically, in World War I, which involved the massive use of chemical weapons, they didn't start with mustard gas. They started with irritants, things not unlike tear gas, and they escalated to start using really terribly lethal mustard gas. In Vietnam, originally, the U.S. military was not supposed to use tear gas, but they discovered by accident, by borrowing some tear gas from police, that they could use it in urban warfare to essentially smoke people out of contained areas and then obviously either capture or kill them. And so that led to massive use of these types of irritating chemical weapons in Vietnam and not as a more humane technique, which is how some people try to sell these. Rather, it was used as a force multiplier, as a way to increase the effectiveness of lethal methods.
The White House continually talks about Saddam Hussein violating bioweapons protocols. In fact, the U.S. hasn't signed on to the International Treaty Against Bioweapons. Is that right?
The U.S. is a party to the Biological Weapons Convention, which prohibits all biological weapons in their entirety. What they did last year, and it was the U.S. standing alone, was they collapsed a six-year-long negotiation to develop an international inspection system. So there would have been United Nations inspectors and a United Nations organization which would have ensured that countries around the world were in compliance, were not producing biological weapons. The U.S. Single-handedly shut this down and, in fact, went one step beyond what it did in Kyoto. In Kyoto, they just said, we're not going to be part of this. In the Biological Weapons Convention, they said, we're not going to be part of this, and we're going to continue to sit in these negotiations and make sure that no agreement happens without us. So we're going to stop the entire world from going forward without us.
And the reason behind that was?
I think that they're rather complicated, but to name a couple of them, I think that the United States would rather go it alone in enforcement. So we would rather bomb people who we think are potentially producing biological weapons than to work through the United Nations to work peacefully. There were also a lot of concerns about intellectual property, so it also had to do with protecting the U.S. biotech industry from a perceived threat from spies on United Nations inspections.
So you're talking about drug companies that refuse to allow inspectors into their plants that collapse this international protocol against biological weapons. Well, I want to thank you, Ed Hammond, for being with us. Again, in the last few months, the House overwhelmingly passed a bill authorizing $4.6 billion for bioterrorism. If you're wondering where some of that funding is going, well, Ed Hammond is talking about that today. He's with the Sunshine Project in Austin. You can look at these documents on the website at www.sunshine-project.org. That's sunshine-project.org. org. As we move now to our second story, South Asian diplomats saying they believe the United States is planning to airlift scores more of imprisoned Pakistanis. They say they've seen a finalized list of the names of 70 detainees. Last month, the Justice Department secretly chartered a Portuguese jet and deported 131 Pakistani prisoners. The prisoners have been arrested for various petty charges and immigration infractions since September 11th, held for months at INS detention facilities around the country. None had been charged with terrorism. They were all flown to Louisiana, where they were flown out. The men and one woman were led to the plane in handcuffs. Many didn't want to go. According to the Washington Post, one man laid down on the tarmac. Another had to be carried onto the plane. Seconds before the plane was about to taxi, a man whose wife had obtained a court order preventing his deportation was removed from the plane. But when the flight touched down 20 hours later, about 50 detainees dropped to their knees and pressed their foreheads to the tarmac. Since September 11th, U.S. authorities have detained 1,200 people, mainly Arabs and South Asians. Not one has been charged with terrorism. According to the figures released by the Justice Department last year, 300 of those detained in the United States were from Pakistan, more than from any other country. We're joined right now by Ahilan Arulananatham, staff counsel at the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Can you talk about who these people were? You spoke with some of those who were detained.
That's right, Amy. I'd interviewed several of the people who were on that plane. They were very much a cross-section of a lot of the people we've seen detained here. Many of them had citizen children, citizen wives. Some of them were working in various capacities. There was a web designer on that plane. There was a man who was a manager of a Dunkin' Donuts, people who were restaurant workers, all manner of people.
And what did they say to you? Why did they end up being deported and others didn't? Was it simply a matter of not having legal representation?
Well, many of the people at the time that I interviewed them were looking for lawyers, and I would imagine, although obviously I didn't speak to them right before they went on that plane, I would imagine a lot of them didn't get lawyers. So many of those people, I think, were people who were trying to stay in the country. I talked to a man who was very scared of going back because he lived very close to the border in Kashmir. He ended up on that plane. But there were other people who had been detained right since the fall, since late September, October, November, who many of whom had been held under very, very harsh prison conditions for much of that time. So many of those people wanted to get out of the country. And one of the most disturbing things about this is that the government has, in many cases, chosen to detain people even after their immigration cases and criminal cases were completed. So those people wanted to go home and nonetheless had stayed here for much longer than they should have been kept.
Now, what kind of difficulty did you encounter in being able to meet with them? We've had many stories of people who went weeks or even months without access to a lawyer or being able to have family visits. What was the process by which you got in to see them?
Yes, Juan. There are several reasons for that. Probably the most important reason is because the government has conducted so much of its campaign in secrecy. So, for example, the ACLU, along with several other organizations, back in the fall, filed a FOIA, a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, trying to get the names and locations of the detainees and the names of whatever attorneys were there. The government has, for the most part, not provided that information. So it was impossible for us to just get a list from the government and go in to see people. Even in cases where we were contacted by the detainee or the detainee's family or a friend or something like that, in order to go into the jails in New Jersey, we had to get, which is where many of these people were held, we had to get prior INS authorization to see them, and it was very difficult. I was turned away from going to see people on several instances when I had gotten all the way to the jails.
How did you learn about the secret airlift, the secret deportation?
We actually didn't learn about the actual method and by which they were taken until after it had come out into the press, but we had heard from people ahead of time that there had heard rumors that there were going to be sort of mass deportations.
But were the detainees able, for instance, to make regular calls to you or to other lawyers, or what's the condition under which they're being held?
Well, because they're being held in so many different facilities, it's difficult to generalize about that. Now, I had heard many of these detainees were held in the Middlesex Jail, which is a county jail in New Jersey, and I heard from many detainees that the phones weren't working. or that it was impossible to make collect calls, for example. So I know that many detainees were trying to seek legal representation were unable to do it for that reason. Similarly, I'd heard earlier about a facility in New York, the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, where phone access was severely restricted by the security rule. So a guard had to come around and give you a phone time, and then you had to get it. And it was very difficult for them to get phone time for that reason as well.
Can you give us some specific examples of people you've represented or you've heard of? Because when the American public hears, you know, immigration infractions, they think, well, maybe there's some serious issues here. What are some examples?
Well, there are many people who are being deported simply for overstaying their visa or simply for working where their visa authorized them to be here but didn't authorize them to work. Or, for example, there was a recent case of a man in Atlanta who is being ordered deported because he failed to report a change of address. So there are many situations in which the immigration infraction is relatively minor. However, but the most disturbing thing about this is not so much that people are being deported for being in the country illegally, which many of them are. It's that, first of all, the groups that are being targeted appear to be quite clearly, despite the government's repeated statements that it's not racial profiling, appear to be all people from either South Asia or the Middle East, the vast majority of whom are Muslim. And even though the government says they're not connected to terrorism, as they said explicitly with these people, 131 on the flight, and as you said in the opening remarks, nonetheless, they're targeting people from these particular groups. That's one thing which is quite disturbing about it. And then the other thing is many of the people are charged with very petty criminal offenses in order to keep them here for a much longer time. So,
what do you mean?
Well, for example, I met some people who were charged. There's one man I met who was charged with making a false statement on a government application. His case is interesting because he was here illegally and he was in the process of adjusting his status because he was married to a U.S. citizen. The immigration judge, after several hearings, stated quite clearly on the record that wanted to release the person pending their adjustment application. But the FBI had not yet determined that the person was not part of the terrorism investigation. There was a process of FBI clearance that was being used.
So now it's guilty until proven innocent.
Yes, and the FBI clearance process very much was that way, and it was running throughout the fall, and you know it may still be running now. We don't know because, as I said, it's a secret process. So shortly after the immigration judge had indicated the intention to let the person paroled and while they're adjusting, the government charged him with making a false statement on a government application. And what he told me the false statement was that he had sought advance approval from the INS in order to leave the country to go to his cousin's funeral in Pakistan. And a friend of his had told him that he would not get the advance approval unless he wrote that it was his mother's funeral instead of his cousin's funeral. So that's what he did. He wrote that it was his mother's funeral. And he told this to the FBI. They interviewed him very, very extensively. They interviewed many of these people very, very extensively. And so they had that on him and were able to charge him with it.
And how was he treated physically?
I'm trying to remember because there are several different detainees. Definitely many of the detainees reported physical abuse in some of the facilities. There was a man who was kept at this Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn that I mentioned who said that when he came in, I believe that was September 30th when he came in, he said he was thrown against every door and every wall for 9 floors on his way up. The cuffs on his wrists were so tight, he said that they were cutting his wrists. And he complained and said to the guards, you know, I'm hurting, cried out to them. And they said, do you know what happened in the city? Did you not hear about this? As though it was some sort of a justification for this man. Again, here's another man. He stayed there for months at that particular detention facility and was never charged with anything related to terrorism.
In terms of those who have been targeted for detention, I know that this was a large group, 131 Pakistanis of the approximately 1,200 total. But clearly, most of the folks who apparently participated in the World Trade Center bombings were from Saudi Arabia originally. Is there particular countries that are being specifically targeted in these detentions?
Hard for me to give a precise answer to that because we only know that small cross-section of the people that we actually managed to see. Most of these people, you know, are in and out of the system without everyone knowing. I've seen a lot of people from Pakistan, seen people from Egypt, from Turkey, from Yemen, from Jordan, but really a host of other. I saw a few people from Mauritania, from Algeria.
You run across any Saudis?
Not that I can recall, but I wouldn't necessarily want to place anything on that.
I would encourage people to go to our website, democracynow.org, and go to the search to listen to the program we had with Greg Pallast and the head of the visa section in the U.S. consulate in Saudi Arabia, talking about how many times he felt he shouldn't give a visa, and he was overruled by, the guy in charge of the CIA working in the U.S. consulate in Saudi Arabia. And the very concerted effort of the Bush administration to stop this kind of any kind of questioning of Saudis.
Right, right.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. If people are concerned about this, we still don't exactly know how many people are being detained, and we're not just talking about detention, we're talking about deportation. Is there word that another deportation is about to take place, a major mass deportation like we just saw?
Well, I haven't heard anything about a mass deportation, but it's interesting to note that even that 1,200 number, I think, is probably low in the sense that many of the people who've been picked up starting in March or so were picked up as part of several new government initiative sweeps that have been going on. There's been a sweep, what they call the Absconder Initiative, which is to pick up people who have a pre-existing deportation order and didn't leave the country, which may happen because they failed to appear at the appropriate time, even when they knew about it, and simply just remained in the country illegally, but may also happen because they failed to receive notice. For example, their attorney doesn't tell them, or it's mailed to the wrong address, or something like that. There's a whole separate set of people like that. I saw a report, the government's figure, saying that 600 people had been picked up as part of the separate Absconder Initiative that was several weeks ago. So there's just a vast number of people that are being picked up. Then I'm sure you would have heard that the jewelry stores were swept, and that those were largely Pakistani-owned jewelry stores. So it's very likely that there's going to be future deportations, and perhaps even another mass deportation. But the detention and arrest of people targeted from these particular ethnic and religious groups, or however you want to characterize it, is definitely continuing.
Are you suing?
Well, we are. We've challenged already the fact that they're holding the deportation proceedings in secret. We've challenged that in two different federal court cases, both of which are on appeal, one in New Jersey and one in Michigan. As I told you earlier, we had sued in order to get more names and locations and names of attorneys. We're also in the work that I'm describing, trying to help individuals by helping them in their own lawsuits, helping them find attorneys and do things like that.
In these hearings, in these detentions, it is not required that people have lawyers?
No. In a deportation proceeding, you can have a lawyer if you can afford it, but you are not guaranteed a right to a lawyer as you are in a criminal trial, typically. So it's very common, actually, in the INS. I don't have the statistics sort of with me, but if I remember correctly, it's something like 60 to 70% of people regularly in their removal proceedings, let alone in the post-9/11 context, go without an attorney. And this despite the fact that immigration law is extremely complicated and technical.
In the case of the woman who got her husband off this plane as it was taking off, how did she manage it?
I'm not familiar with the facts of that particular case, but what's most likely is that an attorney acting on his behalf, I would imagine it's most likely that an attorney acting on his behalf would have filed a stay paper and managed to get the court to stay.
We managed to find a brave judge.
Yes, that's right.
These days.
That's right. That's right. The other thing I wanted to mention, Amy and Juan, is that Representative Frank has proposed a bill in the Congress. Which
Barney Frank of Massachusetts.
Yes, that's correct. Which, the, as I understand it, works to try and correct some of the civil liberties and civil rights problems that have happened with respect to the 9/11 detainees, as well as other kinds of immigration problems.
So once everyone's deported, it'll pass?
It seems perhaps like that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Ahilan Arulananatham from the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to talk about one of the men who was sentenced to death for the killing of Daniel Pearl, what his connections are to the Pakistan Secret Intelligence, Secret Police. You're listening to Democracy Now! Stay with us. The meaningless morality presented to you under the guise of rationality. I feel a shakedown on the horizon. Won't you hop on? You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. A body believed to be Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl was found in a shallow grave in Karachi. U.S. Embassy spokesperson John Kincannon says DNA analysis had been completed and that results will be released soon. Senior Pakistani police officials, speaking on condition of anonymity, say they have overwhelming circumstantial evidence that the body is Daniel Pearl's. Meanwhile, the lawyer for Ahmad Omar Saeed Sheikh has asked a Pakistani provincial court today to overturn his client's conviction and death sentence in the kidnapping and murder of Daniel Pearl. The Pakistani government announced the death sentence on Monday. Saeed Sheikh is also a leading Islamic fundamentalist with reported ties to groups such as the Jaish-e-Mohammed, Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban. His appeal claims the verdict was based on, quote, fake, false, and provenly planted evidence. Today, we're going to take a look at the history of Pakistani intelligence service, as well as its links to the man who has been convicted and sentenced to death for Daniel Pearl's murder, Ahmad Omar Saeed Sheikh. We're joined by Dr. Hamid Hussein, who is author of a piece called Lengthening Shadows, the Intelligence Agencies of Pakistan. It's in the summer issue of Covert Action Quarterly. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy and Juan.
Thank you very much for joining us in our studio. Well, can you talk about who Ahmad Omar Saeed Sheikh is, the man who's now appealing his death sentence?
Now, Omar Sheikh is, he's a British-born American, Pakistani gentleman whose name came up first time in 1993-94 when he was visiting India. And Indian authorities arrested him in connection with the kidnapping of three Western tourists there. He was, the case went on, and no Indian court sentenced him, but he was kept in jail there. The hostages were later luckily released without any harm. He was up till 1999 in an Indian jail. When in December of 1999, an Indian airliner was hijacked from Kathmandu, Nepal, and brought to Afghanistan. And the demands of the hijackers were the release of few people, and Ahmad Omar Sheikh's name came up in that. And in that swap, three people which were released by Indian authorities, one of them was Ahmad Omar Sheikh. And after that, they were brought to Afghanistan, and these people and the hijackers later kind of disappeared from the scene, with the exception of one other person who was a religious leader, Maulana Muhammad Azhar, who showed up in Pakistan and formed that militant group called Jaish-e-Mohammed, which was now, after September 11, has been labeled as a terrorist organization, and he's under detention in Pakistan there.
Now, your article tries to document the ties. It analyzes all the various Pakistani intelligence agencies, but also talks about the ties between him and the notorious ISI. Could you talk a little bit about that and what evidence there is that there were ties between them?
When you look at the Pakistani intelligence agency, especially in the last three, 4 years, You have to look at it as not, contrary to the popular concept of that these relationships are not static or constant, as you're, I'm sure, aware of in all covert operations. Musharraf took power in a coup in 1999. So up till the end of 1999, there is one zone where it's everybody's almost a known truth that Pakistani intelligence agency were supporting the armed groups, Kashmiris from Indian-controlled Kashmir and Pakistani-controlled Kashmiris, and even foreigners, Pakistanis and Arabs, who were trained and sent there, who were fighting inside the Indian-controlled Kashmir there. Come 2000, with an increasing change international situation there, Pakistani government under General Musharraf tried to somewhat go into the background. So they tried to decrease their contact, especially with the extremist type there, so that because the, everything was coming in the news media, and several times Pakistan has been threatened with a label of a terrorist state there. So a lot of those, what you can call a moderate organization, or those who were still closely allied with the Pakistani military, kind of took the advice and kept the low profile. As in contrast, a smaller group which were more ideologically committed, who saw that this is as kind of a sell-off, did not want to go along with that policy. So that group kept their activities. And then the third phase is, so that was going on at a very, because he clearly knew the limitations, so he couldn't do too fast. So that was a slow until September 11. And as you're aware, after in post-September 11 international situation, the whole thing has dramatically changed, where he has to, it's some groups do that part. And that the split between the real radical extremists and the Pakistani intelligence came at that time period, where now they clearly see Musharraf government as a stooge of the United States and a sell-off. So they are clearly against what his current policies are at this
point. But what is the indication that that Saeed Sheikh had was an asset of theirs? Is it just his claim, or is it there other evidence?
There's both. There are two evidences. One is that one is clear that any significant military activity which is going in Indian-controlled Kashmir is cannot go on without the support of the Pakistani establishment there, because that's how they get their weapons, they get their training, logistical support, things there. So just the dynamics of the conflict clearly shows you cannot do that. And second is when he was arrested. Or he claims that he has himself came to the authorities and surrendered because his family was threatened, and he felt that he will be killed in a police encounter, which is a common method in Pakistan, extrajudicial killing there. And when at the same time, when he was arrested, within days, United States asked for his extradition to United States in connection with the killing of Daniel Pearl's murder. And as you're aware, since September 11, there are several foreigners who have been very speedily extradited to the United States. So at that time period, when he was in the police custody, some leaks came into the press where he starts seeing his previous cooperation with the ISI in Kashmir operation there. That was the time period when suddenly he was put in a solitary confinement with no connection, and you stopped hearing anything from that part there. And at the same time period is we never heard from the State Department, came up that, well, he's in the Pakistani custody, so we'll let them try in Pakistan.
And you mentioned in the article that when he surrendered to someone specifically, this Brigadier Ijaz Shah, who was his handler at the ISI?
Yes, so far the evidence is that, according to the prosecution, he was arrested by police in Karachi on February 13th, while he claims, and when his wife put a petition against extradition, is they claim that about 8 days earlier, they have surrendered in another city in Lahore in the presence of Brigadier Ijaz Shah, who's a retired brigadier who has worked in ISI before, and currently he is the Home Secretary, which is the person in charge of internal law and order of that province, and the Deputy Inspector General of Police in Lahore.
And you say that the hijackers were released in this hostage deal. This was a few years before.
Mm-hmm.
They were in Afghanistan. And then Ahmad Omar Saeed Sheikh made his way back to Pakistan.
Yes.
Where did he live? Was the government aware of where he lived?
After that, Pakistan government has not acknowledged his presence, in contrast to the other gentleman, Maulana Muhammad Azhar, who was publicly seen in the public. And this guy, we never heard his name, and Pakistani government never acknowledged that he's in Pakistan. He was living in Lahore. His family is there, and he was doing a business. He got married, and he has about, I think so, a four-month-old baby now. And his name came up when after the kidnap of Daniel Paul, and when the three other accused who were arrested and they were interrogated, then they according to the government, that they gave the name of Omar Sheikh being the main suspect.
Well, was there any evidence to indicate the government, in fact, knew well that he was there, living there openly with the business?
That's pretty obvious there in a country like Pakistan, especially with someone who has, at this level, not a petty criminal you're talking about, somebody whose name has been in international Interpol list there.
You also mentioned that when the newspaper the editor who decided to publish his account suddenly was fired and had to flee to the United States for asylum?
Yes. What happened was when the story, there is another, I mean, the what you call interagency jealousies and conflicts in there. So when he was in the police custody, some of information about his relationship with intelligence was leaked, and the newspaper published from Lahore called The News, which is the leading English language newspaper, got the story, and they wanted to publish that. Intelligence got the know about this thing there, so they asked both the owner and the editor to kill the story, but the editor went ahead and published the story, but then he came under severe pressure, and he has to leave the country, and now he's in the United States.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. This article, has it yet come out? Is it just coming out now?
Came out day before yesterday.
So people get a hold of the Covert Action Quarterly. We have been speaking with the author of the piece, Hamid Hussein, Lengthening Shadows, the Intelligence Agencies of Pakistan. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Michael Yeh, Anthony Reparation Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. We still have some job openings at Democracy Now!, both producer position as well as office manager, and you can send your resumes to job, @democracynow.org. You can also just check out these job offerings on our website at www.democracynow.org. You can also email us, let us know your thoughts on the program, criticisms, comments, suggestions for stories at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Monday in Democracy Now! We'll talk with Lori Berenson's parents about the Inter-American Commission decision that has been handed down to Peru, that they say they will challenge, that Lori Berenson's trial was unfair. And we'll get the latest on that. They are saying they will sue, and this is unprecedented. Peru will sue the Inter-American Commission based in Washington, D.C. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!